The orchestra that was playing at the Copenhagen Grove was Freddie Martin and his orchestra. The one thing I remember about him, his theme song, his opening theme song to start his evening of entertainment, was a popularized version of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto, which of course I was very familiar with, so that was a neat little bonus there, right there.
The voice of Ed Dover, who once worked at the famous Coconut Grove nightclub in Los Angeles, way back in the 1940s, will revisit the long-gone Hollywood icon on this special edition of The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
Tom is very charming and intelligent, and, you know, most people know that, but he's very funny as well. And it was that sort of entrance into his personality that it became very easy for me to sort of work with him.
Production designer Shane Valentino discusses his work alongside Tom Ford and the dark underside of LA on the set of Nocturnal Animals. All that plus a guided tour of the city sights in this special Los Angeles edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show. I'm Ben Rylan. Today's program is taking just a slightly different format. To celebrate the release of Monocle's new travel guide to Los Angeles, we're presenting a special audio tour of the home of American cinema. When I was growing up in Australia, traveling to the faraway town of LA felt like a dream that was so relegated to the realm of fantasy, it was impossible to imagine ever actually making it there. People would say that the idea I had of the city didn't exist, that I'd somehow been hypnotized by classic Hollywood cinema and the real LA would inevitably disappoint. Well, I was sure they were wrong. Let me take you now on a little bit of a walk through one of my favorite parts of Los Angeles, where classic Hollywood still shines very bright, the Hollywood Hills. I was seated at a street-side table on Sunset Boulevard, seeking refuge from the fierce Californian sun by way of an oversized iced tea, when I caught a nearby tourist wonder aloud where the famous mansion seen in Billy Wilder's 1950 classic film Sunset Boulevard might be located. It reminded me of William Holden's character dismissing Norma Desmond's sprawling residence.
It was a great big white elephant of a place. The kind crazy movie people built in the crazy 20s. A neglected house gets an unhappy look. This one had it in spades.
My first visit to Los Angeles came long after that house had been replaced by an office tower. I just caught a screening of the classic film noir Too Late for Tears, and scenes of its star Elizabeth Scott driving frantically all over dimly lit 1940s Hollywood were still fresh in my mind.
Well, I'm just taking my cue like a little gentleman.
You're taking it a little too fast.
Isn't that what you wanted?
Did you notice where the liquor was when you went through my kitchen?
Sure.
Go make us a drink.
Elizabeth Scott stopped making films in the mid-1950s and, even during her career peak, rarely gave interviews. I wondered about the view she must have had of the city's evolution from her longtime home in the hills. I knew an interview was out of the question, but she often responded to queries by post that sparked her interest. We had been exchanging a few letters, and she'd agreed to a meeting at her home. The area of Los Angeles known as Hollywood is really a small player in the city's wider urban landscape, but it symbolizes far more than a location. The movies gave the city its mythology, and it's the people tucked away behind the closed doors of the mysterious Hollywood Hills homes who give the town its legends. It's within these walls that the city's character was crafted, studios started, classics created, dreams destroyed. It's also a town of contrasts, both the birthplace of American glamour and its first greasy tabloid magazine. Leaving behind the grid of downtown Hollywood, I tucked my map away and headed for the hills. Many of the houses along Valley Oak Drive hark back to an age not so long ago yet, almost completely forgotten. The early 30s was a strange time for the movie business. The first picture with spoken dialogue had beckoned the end of an era, as movie studios grappled with how to handle lucrative stars who had tantalized crowds in their masses on the silent screen, yet couldn't deliver a spoken line to save themselves. Ramon Navarro was one of the relatively few exceptions. After starring in 1925's silent epic Ben-Hur, the film that helped establish MGM as the greatest movie studio of them all, the dashing young actor was one of the world's greatest stars.
Love has nothing to do with marriage.
No?
No. Love is women. The excitement of the chase. The thrill of conquest.
In the spring of 1930, Navarro had just taken home a healthy $125,000. But when his payment for a new car was declined, he made a devastating discovery. One of the screen's biggest stars of the day was left with an account balance of just $160. Just as the great walls of the studio backlots ensured secrecy for the movie magic conjuring within, old Hollywood secluded its stars from scandal wherever possible. Navarro kept the betrayal quiet, but covered his losses by taking possession of Samuel's newly built home designed by Lloyd Wright, the son of Frank Lloyd Wright. The palatial Samuel Navarro House watches over the Hollywood Hills and stands as one of the city's longest surviving masterpieces of Art Deco design. With a Mayan-influenced exterior, the lush interiors were assembled by MGM art director Cedric Gibbons, who filled the home with curiosities, courtesy of luxury department store Bullock's Wiltshire. Another Art Deco marvel still standing on Wiltshire Boulevard. Much of Los Angeles was built for one purpose, to be seen. It's a voyeuristic kingdom built upon an industry of watching. A sentiment reflected in its palaces, from the cave-like Sheets Goldstein House on Angelo View Drive and its floor-to-ceiling glass walls, to Frank Lloyd Wright's Stora House on Hollywood Boulevard and its bizarre temple-like textile blocks. Then there are the less obvious homes, small, quaint, swimming against the tide of what Hollywood tells us it's all about. The one-bedroom mid-century Studio City house where Rock Hudson was photographed for Architectural Digest might not match the splashy celebrity we imagine. Similarly, Elizabeth Scott's secluded home towards the winding peak of Hollywood Boulevard is a world away from Norma Desmond's foreboding castle walls in Sunset Boulevard. Perched like a farmhouse atop all of LA, one might imagine that stepping through the gates of a noir legend's home might be like travelling through time. Instead, the house designed by Robert Byrd in 1940 stands as a landmark of elegant and timeless design, with panoramic views taking in the downtown district, the Paramount Pictures backlot, where the scene of Norma Desmond's unexpected visit to Cecil B. DeMille took place, and the neighbouring Hollywood Forever Cemetery. Bouncing down the path with entirely unexpected energy, her hair was still as blonde as it shone during her final starring role opposite Elvis Presley, and her style was still as casually confident as her few public appearances alongside co-stars Humphrey Bogart and Kirk Douglas in the 1940s. Nearly 60 years after her final leading role, she remained quite literally on top of all of Hollywood. Cities change, and so too do their buildings. Yet, as the friendly character of her home suggests, she was far from a Norma Desmond-style recluse. Elizabeth Scott and Ramon Navarro came from a generation of movie makers who understood the value of mystery, and their homes reflect that timeless sensibility. Like their owners, many of them crazy movie people, the houses of the Hollywood Hills have watched countless grand dames of the cinema screen rise and fall. And here they stand, just as tall as ever. That was my essay from Monocle's new guide to Los Angeles, which of course includes many more insights into the cultural history behind the city that's not always entirely obvious. Tom Ford's debut as a film director came with the kind of audacious confidence rarely seen in any profession. After impressing with 2009's A Single Man, he's back now with the visually lush and immensely unsettling Nocturnal Animals.
Do you ever feel like your life has turned into something you never intended?
I'm worried about you. Were you sleeping?
You scared me the last time we talked.
You know me.
I never sleep. My ex-husband used to call me a nocturnal animal.
I didn't know you had an ex-husband.
I've been thinking about him a lot lately.
The film has been described as a meta-mystery thriller which partly takes place in dusty, nightmarish Texas and partly in the hard, shiny world of LA's elite art scene. From the heights of his profession as a fashion designer, Tom Ford is clearly not the kind of creative force often seen on the screen, which makes me wonder what it might be like for a film design professional to work alongside him. So I dialed up the production designer of Nocturnal Animals, Shane Valentino, to first ask how the film's design reflects the inner torment taking place inside the minds of the characters.
The way for me to maybe kind of answer that in the most direct way I can is to sort of speak about Amy Adams' character in Nocturnal Animals. And, you know, I always felt that that character, when we sort of first got introduced to her, there's a sort of a coolness to her. It's almost as if she's sort of cut off emotionally from the rest of the world. She's a bit isolated in a lot of ways, you know, socioeconomically, because she exists in this world that is of the elite in terms of the financial elite. And then also in terms of the world in which she inhabits in terms of art.
The world inhabited by Amy Adams' character is almost an extension of the high-end gallery in which she spends most of her working hours. And in shaping that world, Shane Valentino took part of his inspiration from another master of the craft.
So I think, you know, like the way I started was it started invoking the films of Antonioni, you know, and I sort of looked at like Red Desert and the way in which he sort of was dealing with Monica Vitti in Red Desert, right? And sort of, and how he did that spatially. The way in which he did that was, you know, there was a way in which he shot her in which she's almost like frames within frames. It's almost as if she's captured by her own environment. Not to say that it's always like a sort of a prison cell, but what you can see in Amy Adams' environment is that it very much feels that way. There's these long corridors. Her stature is very diminutive in terms of the relationship to the space. It makes it feel like she is not very connected to her environment.
The relationship to one's surroundings is surely close to the heart of any designer. But in the case of this film, Shane Valentino found himself working alongside one of the world's leading design minds, a force of the fashion world who made the kind of leap into filmmaking that no one suspected.
You know, when I was having these conversations with Tom, I think, you know, we were always feeling that she has, in, you know, parentheses, a very curated space, right? She is, as a gallery owner, is actually very, is considered and considering the objects at all time. And so everything around her has to have a certain type of meaning and placement. And so that was the way in which we sort of entered that character. And so then when she has this kind of fissure in her world, when she gets the Nocturnal Animals document from Edward, that's where you can see some kind of transformation.
Navigating the landscape set before us in Nocturnal Animals is at times a fairly tricky business. With two narratives running in parallel, it can be easy to miss how one relates to the other. It's only through the precise illustration of these two worlds that we get a clear picture of both, and much of that is down to the relationship Shane formed with Tom Ford.
Tom is very charming and intelligent, and, you know, most people know that, but he's very funny as well. And it was that sort of entrance into his personality that it became very easy for me to sort of work with him. And, you know, because I think that people could say, oh, it's very intimidating to work with someone of his stature and his, like, sort of design stature. But, you know, I always go into these things as I, you know, we want to come together and collaborate on trying to articulate his vision the best way we can. His intelligence is so broad in terms of art and photography and architecture that and film that it was very easy to have these conversations with him about these reference points. Because once you have those shared reference points, it's very easy to sort of talk about how these spaces should feel and how they should work.
Still to come on today's show, we'll head out for a night on the town at a spot that's seen more stars than there are in heaven, the Coconut Grove. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Stay tuned.
Do you like bad movies? No, neither do we. But don't worry, we've discovered a cure for bad films. It's called Mubi.
Sometimes Wells' films aren't very nourishing, they're very exciting. Citizen Kane, I think, absolutely wins the competition for the film that has made more people want to become a filmmaker than any other.
Every day, Mubi adds a new must-see film to its carefully curated selection. No junk-filled mess or endless scrolling. Just an assembly of the best movies from all over the world waiting to be devoured. To sample a whole month of movies for free, just head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Hurry now, the film's about to start.
You're back with The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. And today we're presenting you with a special audio tour of Los Angeles in celebration of the release of Monocle's new travel guide. Now, if you could possibly pinpoint a time in history as Hollywood's heyday, regardless of which decade you chose, there are a few things that would be true. Joan Crawford would be on the screen, Louis B. Mayer would be in his office over at the MGM lot, and they'd occasionally be bumping into each other at the Coconut Grove nightclub.
Gus Arnheim, the star of entertainers and the entertainer of stars, again transplants you to the world-famous Coconut Grove in the Ambassador Hotel, Los Angeles, and presents another program of enchanting music that has thrilled your favorite star and guided their dancing feet in gay fantasy as they assemble here to enjoy the programs we are to give you now.
I've just taken a seat at what's surely this city's most prestigious night spot, the Coconut Grove. It's sometime during the mid-1940s and this place is truly in the midst of its golden age. I'm surrounded by some of the most legendary names of the film world. Katharine Hepburn is seated just a few tables away. She's seated next to her future co-star, Henry Fonda. And I can hear the unmistakable voice of Bob Hope just over my shoulder. He was the host of the 12th Academy Awards ceremony here just a few years ago.
You know what a license plate is? That's the last thing that whizzes over your head when you try to get across Hollywood Boulevard.
Now, I can see the band is just about to kick off, so while I peruse the cocktail list, let's hear from Ed Dover. He was a technician here some years ago and has some fond memories to share with us.
Well, it was a very luxurious place. As I recall, I was going to school learning to be a radio engineer, and there was a notice on the bulletin board that the Coconut Grove was looking for someone to run the public address system for their nightclub. This would have been about in the early part of 1942. The Ambassador Hotel was quite large. It had a lot of rooms, and the Coconut Grove was its primary nightclub, dining area, so forth. When you walked in the lobby of the hotel, of course, it was just a regular lobby, but very, very fancy. The entrance to the Coconut Grove went down several steps to the dining area. And then on either side of the dining area were sort of box seat areas for those who wanted a little more privacy. And my sound booth was at the end of one of those box seat areas. I had to work at night from about 5 or 6 p.m. till about midnight. And so then I went to school in the daytime.
As customary on this occasion, I wish to present your master of ceremonies, a celebrity who needs no introduction.
Thank you.
the orchestra that was playing at the Coconut Grove was Freddie Martin and his orchestra. The one thing I remember about him, his theme song, his opening theme song to start his evening of entertainment, was a popularized version of Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto, which of course I was very familiar with, so that was a neat little bonus there, right there.
Freddie Martin is quite the presence here at the Coconut Grove. There's even a cocktail named after him, the Freddie Martin Frozen Daiquiri, a blend of Puerto Rican rum, curacao, and lime juice. Or if rum's not your thing, the Abbott Dancers have their own cocktail too, a combination of dry gin, peach liqueur, and Lillet Blanc, and some lemon juice. But while Freddie no doubt impresses diners and dancers night after night, there's perhaps another man of the musical persuasion here this evening who's sure to have people talking.
Right next to my booth, there was a table, and at that table was the noted Broadway composer Cole Porter. Of course, he was a cripple. Of course, he had had an accident early in life that sort of didn't allow him to walk. But at his table, he would have several guest servicemen, Navy or Army kids, sit with him. And then I remember one night, they had a special auction. Some of the more beautiful and glamorous lady film stars would offer themselves up to dance, be dance partners with anybody who bid on their particular person. So they would dance with them, and the money would go, of course, to the wartime charity. Well, Cole Porter, he could not dance, of course, but he would bid on the various ladies who would come up to the bandstand and offer their dancing services. And then when he would win the bid, he would turn it over to one of his serviceman guests.
I've just placed my order for an Abbott Dancers cocktail while Cole Porter generously hands over the spotlight to his dinner guests. But it seems Ed is already thinking about dessert.
During the intermissions, I would sometimes go down from my control booth, and there was an area behind these special seats where the servers had the food set out, ready to serve out to the various tables. And sometimes the people who ordered that stuff wouldn't eat it. It was just there. And so sometimes I would go behind these booths, and if there was anything left over from the very, very good food they served, especially desserts, I would be able to go back there and sort of steal a little bit of that.
And he certainly would have been eating well. A menu dated April of 1948 suggests appetizers of shrimp and crab meat cocktail, followed by a main of sea bass sauté, or breaded chicken with corn fritter. And for dessert, how about a slice of chocolate cream layer cake, or perhaps the Savarin au rum glace? With such elegant surroundings, delicious food, and a crowd of motion picture legends, the people here at the Coconut Grove might have been forgiven for thinking the place would live on forever. But sadly, that wasn't to be the case.
I'll bet they're not so.
We interrupt for this bulletin just in from our WCCO News Bureau. It's from Los Angeles. New York Senator Robert Kennedy was shot in the hip as he left the platform from which he had made a victory statement.
The party's over. It's time.
On the evening of June the 5th, 1968. Democratic presidential candidate Robert Kennedy was shot and killed as he walked through the main kitchen of the hotel. His violent death sent shockwaves through America, and while it didn't directly bring about the hotel's end, it certainly coincided with a rapid shift in the American psyche. and the city of Los Angeles was just one of many feeling the effects of immense change. The neighborhoods surrounding the hotel took a downturn, and no degree of facelift or renovation could bring the once glamorous location back to what it was. Camilo Silva has been working on a documentary about the rise and fall of the hotel. He has a few thoughts on why the demise of the Ambassador is symbolic for the wider city's attitude towards its own history.
I don't think the city really had a chance to mature and be reflective about itself, you know, as the years went on. I think today the Ambassador was very galvanizing moment for preservation within the city. I think now they're saving absolutely everything. I think it was a time in LA history, this is coming off of the heels of the 1990s, the Rodney King riots. I think that was a pinnacle moment in the history of Los Angeles, a very tense time to live in the city.
Throughout the 1990s, the building was little more than a derelict shell until the last remaining section was finally torn down at the beginning of 2006. And while the loss of this incredible place was deeply felt amongst those who understood what it meant to the city, Camilo Silva believes it ultimately resulted in a better appreciation for the history of Los Angeles.
LA as a city really started, I think, transforming on all levels. You see downtown, you see Wilshire Boulevard, everywhere really in the city. There's been massive changes since then. And I think the Ambassador was a victim of that moment in time. If this would have been pushed back maybe 5 years, I still think the Ambassador would have been saved today.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed our audio tour of Los Angeles. If you have been inspired to pay the city a visit, be sure to pick up a copy of Monocle's new guide to Los Angeles, hitting a bookshelf near you any minute. And there were a few other books that provided inspiration for this episode. MGM, When the Lion Roars by Peter Hay, published way back in 1991. The RKO Story by Richard B. Jewell, published even before that, 1985. And one of my personal favourite books, Hollywood in the 30s, by Robert Nippold and Daniel Kothenschult. The hardcover coffee table book is published by Taschen, and it's so beautifully presented. There are no photographs. It's all original illustrations. Hollywood has never looked so good. And speaking of beautiful design, Monocle's own design program, Section D, has just put together a special program focusing on the role of design in movies. Head to monocle.com for a listen. Next week on The Cinema Show, I'll sit down for a chat with the extraordinarily talented Canadian filmmaker, Xavier Dolan.
What matters in making movies is that the movie you are watching is all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity.
That's next week's special focus on Xavier Dolan, where we'll also review all six of his films. Today's program was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. And as we've heard today, times indeed have changed. So we'll leave you now with Cole Porter singing the title song from his 1934 musical, Anything Goes. I'm Ben Rylan. Bye for now.
Anything goes.